Good afternoon, and welcome to a joint webinar presented by HCAA, Healthcare Administrators Association, and the FHIA Group. Hi, everybody. My name is Adam Russo, co-founder and CEO of the FHIA Group. With me, as always, for this special edition webinar is my good friend and Senior VP and General Counsel of the company, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
And today we want to thank all the members of our HCA, their board of directors, and especially Carol Berry for being an innovator and coming up with this unique idea over the summer, not now, and with that cold weather's coming and, you know, it's getting dark at 4:30 here Eastern time. But I want to make sure we say thank you to Carol for the idea to come up with this, for the idea for the topic of this webinar, which is called The Good, the Bad, and the Naughty, Ethics, Simple Mistakes versus Breach. So we have hundreds of people that have signed on. We're really excited about the opportunity to speak to you today. It's going to be an hour-long webinar, and as always, if you've been to our webinars in the past, you can feel free to type in your questions, and if we have time or if we think it's a valuable question, we will read it. If we think it's a stupid question, we will make fun of you live on the air. We promise to do that as well. But this is very different than any webinars we've done in the past because I think it's bringing up issues and topics that I think a lot of people are afraid to talk about. It's maybe a taboo type of subject. But if anyone knows Ron and myself, we're not really afraid of bringing up or talking about anything at all in the industry. But the other people that typically do listen in our webinars, they were afraid. So there is no Jen McCormick. There is no Chris Aguirre. We call him One Slide, by the way.
One Slide Chris.
And John Jablon also will not be on this. We figured that if anyone gets in trouble, if it's Ron or myself, we still have job security.
Who better to talk about ethics, Adam?
That's right, Ron. Perfect. So let's go over the table of contents. Next slide. And that is, we're going to talk about ethics in our industry, innovation versus violation, fiduciary duties and ethics in the news. A lot of news stories out there relating to ethics. I'm not even talking about the presidential race. And then last but not least, best practices and ideal ethics. So before we get into that, I have a couple things I wanted to bring up. And, you know, a lot of these words get thrown around, right? Innovation, violation, fiduciary duty, ethics. I think a lot of this ties into the definition of, you know, every plan that we pretty much look at has some type of definition or discusses that in a plan, the sponsor, the fiduciary, has a duty to be prudent with plan assets. And people always assume that if you're prudent with plan assets, Ron, that means you got to be cheap. That's not what it means. If you look up the definition of prudent, and I did that before I got on this call today, it means characterized by arising from or showing prudence, marked by wisdom or judiciousness, shrewd in the management of practical affairs. That's what it means, having or showing careful good judgment. So it could mean that you're just making the right decisions, regardless of whether or not it's cost-effective necessarily, but in the long run, it makes sense. So we thought, I just wanted to make sure I brought that up, as well as the definition of what ethics is, because we're talking about ethics, right? And the definition of ethics is moral principles that govern a person or group's behavior. The branch of knowledge that deals with moral principles. All right? So, again, it's rules of behavior based on ideas about what is morally good and bad. I just want to make sure we got those out there because I think sometimes people don't really understand what those words mean. So as we go over these issues and we go over this hot topic and this touchy subject, especially what we're seeing in our industry, and especially in the self-assured industry today, I think we need to make sure we discuss this. Also, as we look at what's happened recently in the presidential election, and people are obviously trying to figure out whether it's a good or bad thing, the fact that we have President-elect Trump in office now as it relates to self-funding, I think an argument can be made either way. The bottom line is we know that there's a lot of disruption going on, and that's when we blossom on. You and I are pretty good when it comes to disruption. So with that, let's talk about ethics in our industry, innovation versus violation. And again, go right back to that same thing. What is innovation? What does it mean? Something new or different. That is the beauty of being a self-funded plan, is that you can literally create in your plan design, in the way you aggregate your data, in the way you scrub your data, you can always find new and different ways to introduce things. No question. New methods of identifying risk. New methods of reducing the cost of care. Innovation is literally living in a self-funded world. The problem is, do sometimes you, and I'm going to use the definition again, Ron, are we creating something new or introducing something different that is in complete violation of what's allowed. That is the broader problem. It's really easy, folks, to be compliant if you just follow last year's plan design, if you know last year's plan design is compliant. It's a lot harder to innovate unless you know you're not violating something. And again, we all know what violation is. It's violating is breaching something. You're breaching a rule. You're breaching a law. You're breaching a network contract. You're breaching a stop-loss contract. You're breaching your administrative service agreement. There are you're breaching state law, Obamacare, the Unaffordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it. You're breaching it if you're innovating, potentially. So there's a fine line that needs to be drawn. So it's important, and we do this here all the time. We have so many ideas, folks, that we write down. And we're going in the middle of this right now as we speak as it relates to our employee benefit plan and our handbook. For those of you who don't believe it, we've spent the last 2 months redlining our own plan document as well as redlining and adding changes to our employee handbook. Why? We know that there are certain things that we would love to do that would be in violation of our current network agreement. Or there are certain things that we want to do that potentially go against what's in our handbook right now. So that's why we have to, while you're innovating, you have to also make sure you're not breaching any type of contract that's out there. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ron to talk about ethics in our industry, innovation versus violation. Ron?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I'm really glad you actually brought up that fine line because you're right. The more services, the more vendors, the more new ideas that are out there, you referenced innovation, there are additional opportunities to create ethical violations and then also fiduciary violations. And it's important that we understand that there is a difference between the two. And the question is, acting ethically as a plan fiduciary, as a plan advisor, someone who is acting on behalf of the plan, is that the same as acting ethically as an individual? And the answer is no. And this is, I think, where a lot of the confusion comes from. You see a lot of services out there, programs that are out there, and a lot of people who are behind those services that are very passionate, very enthusiastic about what they're offering. But when you tell them, well, you know, if I do what you're telling me to do, I may potentially be breaching my contract, or I may potentially be upsetting the apple cart, which is going to turn around and cause some sort of a lawsuit against the plan. I may be leaving somebody out to dry. And the response is always, yeah, well, you know, that's not fair. That's not right. It's not right that it's that way. It's not fair that they charge you that much. It's not right that they bill you that way, that they don't provide you with that information. That contract is criminal. That contract that's binding you, it's unethical. And so you should just ignore that contract because it's unethical. It sounds beautiful when you hear it, but in reality, if you go and take action, even if you feel in your heart it's ethical action, that in turn results in a loss or damages to the plan, you have potentially breached your fiduciary duty and acted unethically as it relates to your duty, your obligation to that plan. So the same way they talk about fiduciary duty when it comes to ERISA and the fact that you have to put the plan's interests ahead of your own, you have to put the plan's interests ahead of any individual plan member. So, too, you have to put the plan's interests in what's right and justifiable and ethical and legal from the plan perspective ahead of what you may think is ethical or justifiable or, in this case, legal. So some of the examples that we see when it comes to creative thinking, innovation, areas that somebody's trying to do something to contain costs but are potentially pushing up against that ethical limitation that's placed on us as a plan fiduciary, of course, exclusions, right? Because if I just pay every claim, nobody's complaining. No one's ever going to say anything about it. But when it comes to exclusions, that's always what tends to raise the red flag because the provider is not being paid, because the patient is being balance billed. This is what brings a claim to somebody's attention, is that it was excluded. And one example of an exclusion we frequently see relates to the issue of causation, right? So let's say hypothetically I have an exclusion in my plan document that indicates the plan's not going to pay claims if somebody is in the middle of some sort of a hazardous activity or more specifically, operating a motorcycle without a helmet or, an illegal act. And in this particular state, you're required to wear a helmet while operating a motorcycle. So there's many different ways that this can come into play. person's in an accident, they're riding a motorcycle, they have no helmet, but they don't injure their head. They injure their foot. The helmet itself doesn't have any impact on the injury. So the question is, does the exclusion apply even though the lack of a helmet didn't actually cause the injury itself? This goes to that issue of causal versus temporal link. Was it something that was happening while the person was injured, or is it something that caused the injury? Another example that I used to give when I was training our staff was, if I've got somebody and they're busy smoking a crack pipe, walking down the sidewalk, are they committing an illegal act? Of course they are. An air conditioned unit from an apartment above them falls out of the window and cracks them on the head. I'm pretty sure that'll kill you. But in this case, they survive. But there are serious claims. They're airlifted, all the medical bills. You have an exclusion in your plan document that says that the claims are excluded if they were injured during the commission of an illegal act. Were they injured during the commission of an illegal act? Yes. Now, the next kind of exclusion, it says the claims are excluded if the person is injured due to an illegal act.
No.
In this case, it had nothing to do with the illegal act. So, one, understanding what the plan language says. Two, understanding whether there's a requirement of causation or is a temporal link enough. And these are the types of things you need to keep in mind as you receive these claims. In addition to that, you're starting to see a lot more involvement by third parties when it comes to things like medical necessity, experimental, investigational, usual, customary. A lot of organizations out there are offering to take claims data and reprice it. They're telling you that the medical bills are excessive. They're unfair. They're unjust. They're unethical. You get these bills, ignore your network contract. Give us those claims. We're going to put it in our black box. We're going to reprice it. We'll tell you what to pay. And you just pay whatever we tell you. If you just blindly follow those instructions, are you fulfilling your obligation on behalf of the plan to apply knowledge, information, the plan terms to the claims repricing? I would argue no. And there's actual case law out there where if you can't justify the basis for the pricing, if you can't explain the tool, the information, the data that you used to achieve that price, then you've acted not only in breach of your contract and in breach of your fiduciary duty as a plan administrator, but you've also potentially acted unethically because you've done something that we call arbitrary or capricious. If you put a bunch of numbers up on the board and throw darts, and that's the number you're going to use to determine what to pay, that's unethical. There's a requirement you put a certain amount of effort into these things. Another issue that we're seeing all the time is the issue of gaps. You know, if you don't know, and in this case, ignorance may be bliss, but at this point, if you're looking at a plan document and it says one thing, and you're looking at a stop-loss policy and it says something different, and you know that there are instances where the plan may be called to pay something, and the plan covers it, and stop-loss explicitly excludes it, if that ends up happening and there's no reimbursement for this plan and you knew this could happen and you just decided it would take too much effort to fix the gap, to close the gap, you've potentially not only breached your duty but also acted unethically. And we've seen this happen. Advisors out there are aware, or this is scary, should have been aware and did nothing about it. Another one, and this is a pretty obvious one when you hear it during a webinar, but in real life, you'd be amazed how many people think this is okay, are the VIP exceptions. This is where, let's say, 9 times out of 10, something happens to an employee of the company, and we read the plan document, we determine that the claim is excluded. Okay, no problem, exclude the claim. Great. But then when the CEO's kid, it happens to them, oh, that's not what the plan means, this claim is covered. That kind of discrimination, that kind of unequal application of the plan, not only a breach of your duty, but also unethical. Now, let's talk about some other examples of where ethics and innovation tend to butt heads. Again, you're seeing a lot of ideas carve-outs where, for instance, people will identify a high-dollar claim, right, something that tends to be very costly for the plan. Great example would be dialysis, for instance. That's probably one of the biggest carve-outs you see. Specialty drugs, another one. Oncology, another one, right? So Let's say somebody comes to me and says, hey, we've got this great program. You got to adopt it, put it in your plan. You're going to save all this money. Wonderful. Great news. Can I apply it right now? Well, why do you want to apply it right now? Well, Joe in accounting, he needs dialysis, and he's costing me too much money. And the only reason I'm adopting this program is because I want to target him. Whoa. If you want to apply a program to your plan that's going to create savings for the plan in general, by all means, be proactive. But if it's clear that you're doing this specifically to target someone who's already treating, it's easy for them to say, the only reason you're doing this is to target me.
To discriminate against me.
That starts to butt up against that issue of ethics. Let's take it one step further, or one step back. Retroactive. Scary stuff. I've been told, hey, listen, could we apply it in 2017 and then demand overpayments back from 2016?
This is a comment that we get at least once a week, asking about retroactive effects on plan changes.
Just think about it objectively. You can't tell someone that something's covered now and then in the future change it and then retroactively, as if you had a time machine, come back and take it back. It just doesn't work that way. Last but not least, a conflict of agreement. If you sign a contract with someone, for better or worse, whether you think it's fair or abusive, at the end of the day, you sign that contract, and that entity has an expectation that you're going to obey. Next, processing claims without a summary plan document. I understand. You want the claims to be paid. You don't want there to be a conflict. You don't want a lot of people with angst. I get that. But you cannot just make a call, you know, I feel like paying it today, and since there's no plan document, there's nothing stopping
me. Now, here's the key to this, Ron, right, where I disagree a tiny little bit, is we know that the general business practices is that every one of our clients, whether they're a broker or their TPA, is going to say, we just don't have the plan, and it hasn't been approved, yet we have claims that are coming in for these people. So, obviously, what do you do? You're putting yourself in a bind. We would advise a TPA to get something in writing from the employer group or the plan sponsor stating that not due to your mistake or your efforts, but you do not have a finalized approved plan document. However, based on the best efforts, you believe that this template or this is the type of rules that the plan is going to follow so that a claim does come in, you're making the right decision. Because we often get involved. Actually, I have a call in 1 hour from now about a situation similar to this where a claim was processed by an administrator. That claim, the administrator thought it was payable. The employer said it wasn't payable, but there's a lot of emails going back and forth, really hard to figure out whether it should have been covered. So that's why saying don't process claims with SPD makes sense, but in the business world, and the reality of the situation is, you know, we're not living in a world of unicorns, right, is that sometimes – this will happen on January 1st or January 2nd. So
if you want to act ethically in this type of situation then, and it's like Adam said, you have to CYA. And it's amazing that both ethics and CYA meet. You have to make sure there's something there that at least provides some sort of guidelines so you ensure the plan administrator still has control. Again, if you unilaterally just apply clinical standards, I understand you're using some sort of objectively fair threshold to decide how to process claims, but you should really present that to the plan administrator first and say, until we have a plan document, here are the standards or thresholds we want to use. Getting that sign-off may seem difficult, but it's the ethical thing to do.
Now, in regards to the clinical standards, we see a lot of people playing around with this where we believe it's not ethical, where they look at the result that they want that's going to end up being in their best interest. Not all clinical findings and clinical research and clinical reviews are the same. You have some clinical reviews that are done by real doctors, real nurses, people that are being, quote-unquote, independent. And then we see others, Ron, that we both know there's an agenda behind the review and behind decision-making. So, again, great point there.
Speaking of making sure everything is agreed upon ahead of time, you know, we look at things like PBMs and rebates, and this is not on an island. There are many other issues like this where, you know, if it's mid-year and the plan sponsor doesn't know where the rebates are supposed to go or if they're going to be getting any of the rebates or your TPA doesn't know if the PBM is providing any rebates or how it's being treated. If you enter into one of these arrangements and you don't know ahead of time how the money is going to be dispersed and where it's going to go and whose responsibilities are what, not only is that a potential breach of your responsibility, but it's also potentially unethical if they're relying on you for this type of professional guidance. Last but not least, you know, and this is something that you may want to take a look at, is that level of separation, almost a firewall between who's handling the claim at the initial level, who's handling the next level appeal, who's handling the final appeal. Because if you're a plan participant and your claim was denied at the initial level, you want to make sure that whoever's reviewing your appeal has at least some level of objectivity and that they're not basically looking at this claim and saying, well, gosh, you know, maybe I made a mistake, but I don't want anybody to know. I'm influenced as a conflict of interest towards denying it again. You want to make sure there is that level of objectivity when it comes to these types of questions. And these are just some examples of instances where we see opportunities for unethical or ethical behavior.
Now, I'm going to go back to me, a couple more ideas regarding the fine line of innovation versus violation. These, to me, are pretty questionable ethics. We see this all the time. And I get it. The first one, TPA failing to recover an overpayment to avoid highlighting its mistake. We understand that. We've heard many times where we're talking to an administrator, they say, Adam, Ron, you know, we understand we're trying to get that money back, but we don't want to go back to the employer group because we're highlighting our mistakes. So we understand that. But just remember one thing. In the administrative service agreement and in the plan document, there are duties to actually recoup the funds on behalf of the employer-sponsored plan. We have seen lawsuits already where the group did not allow the administrator to actually try to recoup the funds of the provider. Instead, they just sued the TPA directly for making an overpayment, a mistaken payment. So, again, a lot of this stuff that I'm bringing up here is going to be tied back to the actual administrative service agreement and what the TPA's duties were in relation to the administration and processing of particular claims. The failure to disclose fees. Again, go back to your administrative service agreement. We have written over 300 administrative service agreements for various entities in our industry, and we can tell you that a lot has been done in regards to true transparency as it relates to disclosing all fees, regardless if it's an admin fee, a piece of the vendor's fee, whatever it might be. That's one of the great things that we have seen with the Affordable Care Act or Unaffordable Care Act is the fact that there's definitely been a lot more disclosure as it relates to what the employer is actually paying for as it relates to a self-funded plan. Leaving money on the table. Again, going back to the situation of being prudent with plan assets, and that's why this is key. Ignoring an overpayment may be ethical. Forget the fault. Correct. If you ignore it, we're talking about this is someone's money that you are not recouping or you're ignoring it's out there because you're hoping no one's going to notice. That is purely, in our opinion, illegal, unethical. Second, subrogation. And conversely, spending $2 to get one. This is one argument we hear all the time. Adam, don't we have a duty? It says in the plan, doc, do we have a duty to recover 100% of the money? I'm like, sir, there's $100,000 available. You're going to spend $200,000 to go to Supreme Court in order to recoup $100,000. Your plan is going to lose another $100,000 or take $30,000 that they're giving you. But we're not following the terms of the plan. That is not true. The plan always has discretionary authority to interpret the terms of the plan, and having a duty to be prudent with plan assets means you're going to make a wise business decision. So you don't spend $2 to get one. You spend $1 to make two. That's being prudent. So an argument can be made both ways in regards to it's okay to sometimes leave money because you're actually spending less money in your effort to try to recoup it. Last, inadequate or lazy discounts. Folks, this one is something that we can literally do a seminar on, at a full-day event. Whether or not if you get a discount and you obtain a discount, you hire a well-known industry vendor, you access a RAP network, you access a regular network, you access a network that 3 million other people also have access to. Can someone argue that you are being unethical? Or can someone argue that you are wasting their money? Or you are not being a fiduciary? You are breaching a fiduciary duty because you only got a 20% discount off the $2 million charge. That's the problem that we see, is that at what point is the discount amount good enough not to be a fiduciary breach? And I think this is where we're going to see potential legal issues, class actions. I think it has to do less with the amount of the discount and more about how much the plan paid above and beyond what the reasonable cost was to administer that care. The problem is, if you have Medicare, if you have Blue Cross Blue Shield reimbursing at 200% of Medicare, and you're paying 180% of Medicare, does that mean that all the people within the Blue Cross Blue Shield network are breaching their fiduciary duty? Are they paying too much? Even though that's what everyone's been doing for the last 20 years. This is an area where I think it's less about the smaller discount and more about just obscene, ridiculous, those I would say outlier claims that it's so obvious where you're paying $1 million on a claim that anyone else would be paying $100,000 on, where you are not doing an adequate job being the fiduciary for the particular plan. Ron, any thoughts on that?
I think that this is something that's going to become more obvious to people as transparency, and I know it's been a keyword everyone's been screaming for years, but I, you know, with the change of the administration now, I know transparency is one of the big things they talk about, and I'm wondering at some point when somebody says, wow, that's really expensive, can we pay less, that the next question they're going to ask is, wait a second, is that what we've been paying in the past? Who's responsible for that decision?
Right. The next slide I want to go over is this. Here's what we know, and we've done the research on this, and we've tallied it up, okay? Over the past 14 years, since we started actually looking at plan docs, we've tried to, you know, this isn't a professional, you know, survey or poll, but you know what? Speaking of professional polling, they don't get anything right either. Might as well just do our polling, okay? Here's what we know. 3 out of every 10 plan docs that we receive are not in compliance with the law. 3 out of 10. So 30% of the plan docs that we're asked to review are literally illegal. Not that they don't have the best language or they don't have the right UNC language or the best language regarding innovation or plan design or what's covered, what's not covered, what makes you eligible, ineligible. We're talking about 30% of the plans literally being illegal. So when you have plans designed as being marketed as ACA compliant and yet they're not, to us, that's a compliance issue, but it's also an ethical issue. Do they know? Do they have a responsibility to let people know that these are ACA approved or, you know, compliant type plans? The next one is a really tricky one, the RBP, reference-based pricing without support. And I'm not going to waste everyone's time here, but if you actually just Google FAQ Part 31, you can read question 7 yourself, where they talk about the fact that if a self-insured plan has a pricing structure which the plan pays a fixed amount, so reference-based price for a particular procedure, but the plan doesn't make sure that the participants have adequate access to all quality providers that will accept this reference price as payment in full. All these questions, is it ethical to offer these types of plans? They might be illegal, but is it ethical? And I think an argument can be made both ways. Next, imposing benefit limitations not found in the SPD. Ron touched about the touch base on this earlier. You have to follow the terms of your plan doc. You can't just come up with these rules because you go, wow, this person's going to cost a lot of money. Let's find a way not to follow the terms of the plan doc, okay? Or you employ limitations based on the health data. Okay, here's what you can do. The beauty of being self-funded is you can take the claims data, take out any PHI, and go, wow, we have an obesity problem. We have a diabetic issue. We have a high blood pressure problem. We have too many people going to the emergency room. What you can't do is go, hey, Ron Peck, I see that this guy is taking a lot of, Nicorettes. He's on Nicorettes all the time. So he must be taking a lot of smoke breaks. So I'm going to fire Ron because he's not at work. He's not working. He's outside either taking smoke breaks or he's all freaked out because of the patch he's got on his arm. That's why his work's not as good. He's not as productive. I'm going to fire him based on the claims data. If I fire Ron because I visually see that he's not doing his job and every time I beep him, he's not at his desk, that's one thing. But to actually fire an employee or get rid of someone because their claims are too high is another story. So we're going to talk about fiduciary duties and ethics in the news. We are not talking about the election, folks. We're going to be talking about just understanding fiduciary duties as a whole. So Wikipedia, the best dictionary in the world, right, Ron?
That's it.
You know, I like to read Wikipedia sometimes to see what's on there, to see if you can try to get things put on that shouldn't be there. It's pretty funny. But here's what we do know.
A fiduciary is a person who holds a legal or ethical relationship of trust with one or more parties. This could be, in my opinion, us. We are. We have a relationship of trust with the hundreds of people on this call, I would think. If there is any way you could actually act unethically with respect to the plan, chances are you are a fiduciary. That is clear and concise. Bottom line, folks, is this. Sit behind your desk, close your eyes. If you think that there's someone out there in a plan that's relying on your expertise or your opinion or your statements or your email or your actions in how they function as a plan, you can be looked upon as being a fiduciary of that particular plan. It's a simple thing. So you know how when they have a, I love these words, right? I love when they say this. So maybe many of you aren't from a place where it snows a lot, but we are. And I love it when they have a snow, when there's a blizzard, and they go, okay, all non-essential government employees get to stay home. So I always tell people, like, hey, are you non-essential? If you think you're non-essential, stay home. So Ron stays home every time.
That's it.
Ron's like, I'm not essential here. I don't need to be there. But I look at that word, non-essential, very similar to the fiduciary. If you think that your actions don't mean anything, are not going to have an effect on the plan as a whole, okay, you're non-essential. It doesn't matter. You're just doing a ministerial act. You're just typing away, listening to your headphones or your earbuds. No, it's headphones anymore. Or Bose. They have the Bose ones. Am I wrong? The best. So the point is, it's obviously when they created the idea of a fiduciary, it's more than just someone who's responsible for something. But in our world, because it's so complex with healthcare reform, it ties to the fact that people expect you to have some type of level of expertise. Because in order to do the things that we're doing, it's so complex. So whereas someone may not have been looked upon as a fiduciary prior to Obamacare, it's possible the same type of actions and responsibilities and duties may hold them to be looked upon as a fiduciary going forward. So, question. I love these. If an entity is not the name fiduciary in SPD, can the entity still be a fiduciary? Yes. 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 If you act unethically in a fiduciary capacity, it's worse than if you just act unethically in a non-essential position. That's just the way it is. So, I love using this example. If you have a deposition, I do this all the time when I speak, and you have the claims manager of the TPA, right? You have Fran, okay? She's been working at the TPA for 40 years. She started off in the mailroom when they had mailrooms, and now she's the head claims manager. And the lawyer for the hospital says, Fran, who makes the claim decisions in your office? And Fran stands up and says, I do. No claim gets paid or denied without me authorizing it. Guess what, folks? Even though Fran's name is not in the SPD, Fran is the fiduciary of the plan because she's making the claim decisions and she has proudly said so. Excuse me. So let's go to the next one, Ron. I am a TPA that just performs these, you know, ministerial claims payment operations. I don't do nothing. I literally do nothing. Can I be a fiduciary? Yes. If you are making a decision, if you're taking a coin and flipping it, deciding heads or tails if a claim is payable because the language in the plan doc is vague, you may be deemed a fiduciary. Now, why is this important? Very simple. The SPD is supposed to be so clear that it actually is basically an instruction manual. It's like when you buy IKEA furniture, okay? And there's an 80-page manual. And you're following it as best you can. There's 75 screws, right, for like one leg of a table, okay? And you're trying to follow the terms and follow the pictures, which are impossible to decipher, right? I can write a plan doc. I cannot do an IKEA. I couldn't put it together.
There's room for interpretation, Adam.
Right. And it's called duct tape. Right, the interpretation.
That seems unethical.
Exactly. The point is, if you can't read the plan doc and make a claim decision every time based on the terms of the plan, you potentially are making a decision, therefore you're a fiduciary. The SPD is the plan sponsor telling you ahead of time what to pay, what not to pay, how much to pay, and when to pay. You are, as a TPA, supposed to be able to just pay it or not pay it based on your system. However, if that was the case every time, no one would be calling Ron and I when they have a claim situation that they have no idea based on the terms of the plan whether it's payable, or it's payable under the terms of the plan but not payable under the terms of the network contract or vice versa. Last,
My ASA specifically says the plan may not hold me as a fiduciary. It means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. If you act as one, if you're getting paid as one, if you're holding yourself such as one, whether it's in the marketing materials, whether it's in seminars, whether it's in any conversation you may have, or though your actions, you may be viewed as a fiduciary. Ron, I'll finally turn it over to you. My voice is gone.
Yeah, have a drink of water there, Adam. A great example of what we're talking about to this point, there's a real-life story very quickly that I can give you to share an example of someone who actually did something ethical. We had a plan sponsor. They were working with the TPA and with a third-party vendor, and they were looking to carve out dialysis. And they did not at the time have any dialysis patients of which they knew, so we can avoid that targeting an individual, that discrimination issue. They were not looking to apply it retroactively, so we avoid that issue. They put plan language in the plan document that was clear. Everybody who was a member of the plan that received a copy of the plan document understood exactly what the rules were, and so that was very ethical behavior, ensuring everybody understands ahead of time what the rules are. In addition to that, they explained this to the providers when a claim for dialysis was sought by one of their plan participants by virtue of the ID card had language, the plan document, correspondence, et cetera, the pre-certification process. Eventually, the provider still attempted to balance bill due to various rules, which we won't get into right now. They were unable to balance bill the patient. They filed an appeal against the plan. The plan said, this is what the plan pays. We've done all these things in support of this decision. I'm sorry, we're not paying anything else. And the provider ended up filing a lawsuit against the plan. And amongst other things, they accused the plan of breaching their fiduciary duty, bad faith practices, and unethical behavior. And the court looked at everything that the plan had done, and in addition to that, during this conflict, the plan had actually, along with these other entities that were involved, they had come to us for an objective third-party review. They went to another entity to seek a clinical review, and so they received these objective analyses of what they had done to ensure everything was done properly. The court looked at that and said, you have taken these steps to ensure objectively that you have made no mistake, that everything you've done is in exact compliance with the terms of the plan document. You have acted ethically, and they supported what the plan had done, and they won the case. That's the type of behavior that you need to take in order to understand or in order to enforce your ethical duties. So what are we talking about here? One, acting in interest of the plan participants, the plan as a whole. There's an example of subrogation case, the Zurich case, where the individual was seriously injured, there was not that much money to go around, and it was very bad for this individual that the plan was looking to recoup some of those funds for the plan as a whole. And the court basically said, yes, we understand that it's bad for this person, but it's the greater good. It's the benefit of the plan as a whole over the benefit of any individual. That is not only a fiduciary duty, but as someone who's acting on behalf of a plan, it's your ethical obligation to put the plan first. In addition to that, you talk about prudence, which Adam mentioned. That's the opposite of arbitrariness or capriciousness. Don't throw darts at a wall. Don't just trust people because they tell you so. Ensure that every decision you're making can be backed by true data, facts, evidence. You can explain why you did what you did, and it wasn't all based on self-interest. Follow the plan document, again, ensuring not only that it's a consistent and compliant plan document, but that you're doing everything you can to obey that plan document. Because remember, the plan document is how you communicate to the plan members. These people who are making contributions to the plan, they're doing so under the assumption that the plan is going to be managed the way the plan document's written. If you stray from that plan document, you're basically telling everybody, hey, you gave me your money, I told you I was going to do A, but in fact I'm doing B, sorry, no refunds. It's basically, in a lot of ways, it's not a contract, but it's the same philosophy. You express the terms, now enforce them. Holding the plan assets in trust, or at least ensuring that there are funds available to pay for these things that you're obligating yourself to pay, and paying only reasonable plan expenses. Again, ensuring that you're not just doing what people tell you because it's the easy or expedient thing to do. Ensuring that you're really analyzing your options and putting the plan's financial interest and cost containment at the forefront of your decision making. It's not only an obligation, but it's also the ethical thing to do. Parties in interest are prohibited from transacting with the plan. Now, this is very tricky. Basically, if you're an entity who's servicing a plan, you have a responsibility to the plan, you need to make sure that you don't enter into any other arrangement with the plan that could potentially create a conflict of interest. You actually see a lot of court cases out there recently, and it's fascinating to me because they've since done surveys to prove that this is not the case. But there were court cases out there where the accusation or the argument was made that a third-party administrator was influenced or incentivized to deny claims. Because at the end of the year, when they're trying to get all of these groups, all these employer group plans, these employers' plan sponsors, to re-up and renew their contract with that TPA, the TPA wants to be able to show the employer, look how much you saved with us, stick with us, that there's this conflict of interest. And that as a TPA or someone whose job it is to process claims in accordance with the terms of the plan document, you shouldn't be influenced to go one way or the other when it comes to payment or denial based on some sort of financial interest or conflict of interest. What's fascinating about that is that you could say that about a self-funded plan and their TPA, but you wouldn't say that about a fully funded carrier that not only has to pay claims, but pays claims with their own money. A TPA is not paying the claim with their own money. And survey after survey has shown that there's actually more objectivity when it comes to a TPA working with a self-funded plan than any other structure. And furthermore, plan participants and plan sponsors agree that there's this level of objectivity and they're not scared of a potential conflict of interest. However, as a party in interest, someone who has this ethical obligation, this duty to the plan, you need to ensure that you're avoiding all potential conflicts of interest and any kind of other business arrangements with the plan that might butt heads with that obligation. So, I've been mentioning in a very vague fashion some of the cases that are out there. We can actually now talk about a few specific cases just to give you an example of what's out there when a TPA or a self-funded plan or a broker or advisor or a vendor is accused of being unethical, that they've taken it too far or ignored all the best practices that we've shared with you thus far today. Let's look first at Cigna v. Humble. In this case, Cigna alleged that Humble, which is the provider, Surgical Hospital, that their billing practices were fraudulent. And rather than go through the appropriate processes to react to what they thought was potentially fraud, they just started withholding payments. And basically the argument was that they were offsetting. The amounts that they felt were overpaid on one person's behalf, they were going to deny on someone else's and balance the books. The problem is they were taking the crosshairs of Humble Surgical and putting them right on the plan participant, the patient whose bills were not being paid. Furthermore, the rules indicate that if you're going to deny a provider's claim, you owe them a right to file and appeal the adverse benefit determination. But the same way, if you accuse them of having been overpaid and demand a refund, likewise, they have that right to react to that adverse benefit determination. Doing this, they did not afford the provider that opportunity. So there were a number of different issues with what they did. It was deemed to be very self-interested. It didn't really take all the parties into consideration as far as how it was going to impact them. It was unethical. It was a breach of their duty, and they were dinged. Seriously, to the tune of $13 million. Oh, Lord. You know, plus 2.3 for bad faith and fiduciary breach. I can only imagine what I could do with that money. I would act very ethically, I promise. Next, we talk about the Little River Band of Ottawa Indians and the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. Here, in this case, you had a plan which in their plan document indicated that they were going to pay claims using Medicare-like rates, that whole reference-based pricing process that Adam was talking about previously. Unlike the examples we gave previously, this plan actually had the language in their plan document, and the claims processor ignored it and applied their usual network-based claims process. Was there some miscommunication during the contracting? Were they being asked to do something that they can't do by contract? I don't know. I'm not delving into those details. But what I am telling you is that if you ignore the plan terms, despite the fact that you have clearly stated that your responsibility is to enforce the plan as written, you're breaching your duty, you're acting unethically, and you're going to be dinged seriously, which, as in the other case, this case too, the plan was able to win an award from the claims processor. So with that, we're going to turn to Mason versus FedEx. And I only recently learned, I know you're going to make fun of me here, that the EX at the end actually forms an arrow. So if you look at the FedEx logo, there's that arrow between the D and the X. It's one of those things where once you see it, you can't unsee it. So now everybody else here, you can thank me when you see a FedEx truck that you saw the arrow. So let's move on to the FedEx case.
Very strange. The Mason v. FedEx case is an Alaska case of 2016. Pretty simple. Aetna, which was the administrator, denied a short-term disability claim. Member appealed, normal stuff. Appeal was denied. Member sued, saying that the actual administrator had a financial incentive to deny the claim and reduce the exposure. What did the court say? Of course they did. Because why? You have an obvious incentive to make a claim denial if it's going to benefit you financially. If you are self-funded, self-administered, this could be something where you can get in a lot of trouble.
Remember what I told you about the conflict of interest and having a party of interest involved in the business relationship? Well, if you're doing business with yourself, the same thing applies. This is the type of case I was just talking about.
The next case we want to make sure we talk about as well is the Pacific Shores Hospital versus United Behavioral Health. This is a Ninth Circuit case back in 2014 where these cases are hilarious. The administrator relied on the patient's medical history and the condition they had to deny an inpatient stay after 3 weeks. The provider, key thing, not the patient, provider sued. Why? Ron's favorite word, assignment of benefits. The ability to step in the shoes. What did they show? The plan relied on telephone conversations to make a determination rather than the actual hospital records. Unethical. Violate a fiduciary duty. Again, the fact that this case went to the went to court, I think is amazing. Like, why wouldn't you go, hey, listen, you caught us. We'll just pay you something. Let's just make this thing go away. It's going to cost money on both sides to lawyers' fees and just time. But again, we have a 2016 case that I just referenced, a 2014 case that was referenced. And Ron, I'm going to throw it back over to you for the last case, which isn't as funny as the one that we just went over, but, you know, still, it's a good lesson.
As an attorney, there's a phrase that'll send tingles up your spine, and that's commingling funds. You're not supposed to commingle funds, but in this case, that's exactly what happened. Now, in addition to that, were there adequate accounting processes in place? Were they doing record keeping to ensure that they knew which portion or percentage of the total account belonged to which client? Maybe. But ultimately, what the court will do is they're going to say it doesn't matter how hard you're doing or what how hard you're trying to ensure that the funds, which are only one account, that there's accurate record keeping. At the end of the day, what you're doing is for your own expediency, your own ease of use, rather than what's to the benefit of the client. And that ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, is what we're talking about when we're talking about ethical behavior. It's sometimes doing something that may not be easy or expedient for you, but is in the best interest of the client. What is legal? What is the fiduciary responsibility? What are the terms of the plan? What are the contracts that you've entered into? What's potentially going to put the plan at risk of a lawsuit or a breach? If you take any steps or any actions that potentially run afoul of any of those questions, you are acting unethically. Don't think about what you think is fair or what you think is right. Think about what's fair, what's right, and what's in the best interest of the plan. And in this case, they did not do that, and that's what the court decided. So let's talk about best practices now.
Yeah, we should be able to run through these pretty quick, Ron, just because of the standpoint of we went over a lot of these cases, and I think based on the stories we've told, it's pretty clear what needs to be done. But we want to make sure that everyone at least gets in this last 10 minutes an understanding of exactly what we need.
It's the lightning round.
Right, let's do it, Ron. I'm ready.
All right. Adam, objective final appeal and review.
Okay, obviously what we want to do is we want to make sure that you have an objective final appeal review. So hire someone else that's independent. If you have a situation where you know the same person is making the initial decision, the denial, then when the appeal comes in, they're denied it again. And then the final appeal process, they're denied it again. And the same set of eyes are looking at it. Just be aware it is possible that it could be viewed unethical. I'm just saying,
If you can, try to have an argument that you can say we made a reasonable effort to have another set of eyes look at this based on the new information given. Because remember, under Obamacare, if it's a clinical decision, it can go to an external IRO. You do not want that external IRO to say, what in the world was going on? How did they deny this claim three times based on the information that's presented to them? So have some independence when you're making these decisions. Ron?
Speaking of making decisions, ensure that everybody knows who's responsible for what, and it's clearly stated in the plan document. Most plan documents that we see will indicate who has discretionary authority to interpret the terms of the plan, who the ultimate decision maker is. Just make sure everybody agrees regarding who that is, who's responsible for what, and it's clearly stated both in your contracts and your plan documents. So everyone who's doing business with you also understands who's responsible for what. It's the ethical thing to do.
If you are an administrator, take a step back. I'll never forget the conversation I had with that one TPA about 5 years ago when I was going off telling people, you don't want to be viewed as a fiduciary TPA. You don't want anyone to think that you're making the final decision. And this guy looked at me and said, why not? I could charge for it. Why not make this problem into a profit center? So again, take a step back. Look at your agreements, one, and then two, more importantly, look at your current process. Are you running an operation where people are making independent fiduciary decisions on behalf of their plan sponsors? If they are, you have two options. One, change your operation, or two, keep doing it, let your clients know you're doing it, and charge for it, or three, offer the opportunity to some other party to make those decisions and take on the fiduciary risk for you. But what you can't do is just close your eyes and say, as Ron brought up in that one case, well, yeah, I know that we're making decisions all the time, and we're binding our clients to our decision, and our clients think we're the experts, but guess what? Everything we write, every disclaimer, every ASA, when you walk in our front door, it specifically says that we are not the fiduciary. Not going to work. Ron?
So speaking of issues with the language, let's also make sure that along with all the specificity that we're promoting here, you're also avoiding any unnecessarily vague provisions. Yes, I understand. It's impossible to predict every possible fact pattern. It's impossible to predict every type of claim that's going to happen. But you also need to ensure that just because it's easy to sometimes include extremely vague or ambiguous provisions, you're not doing so simply because it's expedient or easy for you. If there's an opportunity to add any kind of specificity to the plan language, it's your obligation to do so. If there's a term that may be confusing for a plan member, define it. If you're being very specific in how you calculate usual and customary rates for out-of-network claims, don't just write in the plan document, usual, customary, we'll let you know when we get them. No, explain how you calculate that amount so that people know what to expect from you. That's the ethical thing to do. Adam?
Now, this is an easy one. As we talked about before, 30% of all the plan documents that we review are not compliant. Make sure that you review your plan docs, make them compliant, and then verify after you have a plan document that your plan and you feel comfortable with and like. Not only is it compliant, but it's also innovative. Remember, those two words, innovation and compliance, can go against each other. You can be innovative, but not in violating the law. Verify that every action that you're doing, whether it's paying a claim, denying a claim, the type of a discount you apply, when you pay it, how much time you have to pay it, what the appeals process is, what the COBRA coverage entails, when a person becomes eligible. Look at the handbook. Look at the SPD to see if there's a difference between the two. Make sure that all the actions that your company is doing has language that is supported by language in the SPD itself.
I'll always remember when that CEO of that self-funded plan decided to send one of his employees to Argentina for a knee replacement because he read a magazine about medical tourism, and it was only after that employee had gotten the surgery they realized that their plan document excludes claims for surgeries occurring outside the United States. I don't know how you deal with that. You know how you deal with that? You make sure everything you do is covered by the plan ahead of time.
I know, Ron, you're talking about this next one, but this is not easy to do, this avoidance.
Are you kidding me? You're between a rock and a hard place. I don't know. I always, whenever I do a presentation and I talk about this potential conflict, I usually find some sort of a picture of people between a rock and a hard place. There's a really good one of Homer Simpson from the Simpsons movie I like a lot. Ultimately, you're stuck in this position where, on the one hand, you need to secure a network arrangement for the discount, to avoid balanced billing, to provide network adequacy in accordance with a lot of the FAQs we're seeing. You feel this obligation to enter into this network. Furthermore, from a business perspective, you need to offer a network in order to compete with some of the larger carriers. But on the other hand, you may be forced to blindly pay whatever the in-network provider charges minus a discount. You're limited in what you can audit. You're limited in what you can cut back based on clean claim and usual customary rules and caps in your plan document. But your plan document has all these caps and limits. And furthermore, your stop-loss carrier probably wants to take a more conservative approach when it comes to interpreting your plan document as well. What do you do? It's impossible to say it's an easy fix. But whenever you can do so, look at your plan. That is the founding document. Without the plan document, there is nothing else. And as contracts come in, say, does this contract conflict with my plan document? And if it does, bring that conflict to the one who's presenting the contract to you. Bring it to their attention. Bring it to the plan sponsor's attention. You may be surprised to know that it's not always done intentionally, and a lot of these conflicts can be fixed before you sign the contract.
Last but not least, put the welfare of the plan first, second, and third. Unlike the exchanges, unlike the national carriers, unlike the fully insured plans, we in the self-insured industry have the one benefit and the one advantage is that we can put our clients, our employers, our employees, the employees of those employers and their dependents first by innovating, by looking at the claims data, and by finding ways to reduce the overall cost of claims. That's what we do here at the FIA Group. You have that duty. You have that ability, and that's the beauty of being self-funded. On behalf of HCAA and the FIA Group, I want to make sure I thank Carol Berry, the CEO of HCAA, and her great team and her great board for giving us this unique and humbling opportunity to speak on their behalf and with all of you folks, the hundreds of people that have dialed with us today. Please join us next Monday for a special edition election webinar. We're going to talk about Trump, the first 100 days, what to expect in 2017 as it relates to everything and all this disruption that we're seeing. We appreciate the opportunity that you've given us today. If you have any questions or need access to this, please feel reach out to myself, Ron, or to Carol Berry, HCA. We will make sure that we have this available on all the websites recorded. And on behalf of Ron Peck and myself, thank you and have a great rest of your week. Take care.